The first thing Rusk did was to enclose his wife's resodded bowling green within a stout tennis court-type fence. But two nights after it was in place, at considerable expense, the bowling green was chewed up again. And when Mr. Kramer was consulted, he showed the Rusks how the world's foremost excavators had simply burrowed under the fence to get at the succulent roots. What you have to do is dig a footing around your green 6 feet deep and fill it with concrete. Sink your fence poles in that. Do you know how much that would cost? They tell me you have the money, Kramer said easily. And so the fence was taken down, backhoes were brought in, and the deep trench was dug, enclosing the green. Then trucks dumped a huge amount of cement into the gaping holes, and the fence was re-erected. 8 feet into the air, 6 feet underground, and the armadillos were boxed off. But 4 days after the job was finished, Fleurette Rusk let out another wail, and when Ransom ran to her room, he bellowed, "Is it those damned armadillos again?" It was, and when he and Mr. Kramer studied the new disaster, the situation became clear, as the enthusiastic naturalist explained. "Look at that hole. Ransom, they dug right under the concrete barrier and up the other side. Probably took them half an hour, no more." The scientific manner in which Kramer diagnosed the case, and the obvious pleasure he took in the engineering skill of his armadillos, infuriated Rusk, and once more he threatened to shoot his tormentors. But Kramer prevailed upon him to try one more experiment. "What we must do, Ransom, is drive a palisade below the concrete footing." "And how do we do that?" "Simple. You get a hydraulic ram, and it drives down metal stakes, 20 feet deep. But they'll have to be close together." "20 feet deep, but they'll have to be close together." When this job was completed, Rusk calculated that he had $218,000 invested in that bowling green. But to his grim satisfaction, the sunken palisade did stop the predators he had named Lady Macbeth and her four witches. The spikes of the palisade went too deep for her to risk a hole so far below the surface. But she was not stopped for long, because one morning Ransom was summoned by a new scream. "Ransom, look at those scoundrels." And when he looked, he saw that the mother, frustrated by the palisade but still hungry for the tender grass roots, had succeeded in climbing her side of the fence straight up, and then descending straight down, and she was in the process of teaching her daughters to do the same. For some minutes Rusk stood at the window, watching the odd procession of armadillos climbing up his expensive fence, and when one daughter repeatedly fell back, unable to learn, he broke into laughter. "I don't see what's so funny," his wife cried, and he explained, "Look at the dumb little creature. She can't use her front claws to hold on to the crosswires." And his wife exploded. "You seem to be cheering her on." And it suddenly became clear to Rusk that he was doing just that. He was responding to his wife's constant nagging. "Don't wear that big cowboy hat in winter. Makes you look like a real hick. Don't wear those boots to a dance. Makes you look real Texan." She had a score of other don'ts. And now Ransom realized that in this fight of Fleurette versus the Lady Armadillos, he was cheering for the animals. But as a good sport, he did telephone Mr. Kramer and ask, "Those crazy armadillos can climb the fence. What do we do?" Mr. Kramer noted the significant difference. Always before it had been "those damned armadillos," or worse. When a man started calling them crazy, he was beginning to fall in love with them. "Tell you what, Ransom, we call in the fence people and have them add a projection around the upper edge so that when the armadillos reach the top of the fence, they'll run into this screen curving back at them and fall off." "Will it hurt them?" 6 weeks ago, you wanted to shoot them. Now you ask if it'll hurt them. Ransom, you're learning." "You know, Kramer, everything you advise me to do costs money." "You have it to spend." So the fence builders were brought in, and yes, they could bring a flange out parallel to the ground that no armadillo could negotiate. And when this was done, Rusk would sit on his porch at night with a powerful beam flashlight and watch as the mother tried to climb the fence with her daughters trailing. And he would break into audible laughter as the determined little creatures clawed their way to the top, encountered the barrier, and tumbled back to earth. Again and again they tried, and always they fell back. Ransom Rusk had defeated the armadillos at a cost of $238,000 total. "What are you guffawing at in the dark?" Florette demanded. And he said, "At the armadillos trying to get into your bowling green." "You should have shot them months ago," she snapped. And he replied, "They're trying so hard, I was thinking about going down and letting them in." "You do," she said, "and I'm walking out." That was the beginning of the sensational Rusk divorce case, though of course many problems more serious than armadillos were involved, and most of them centered upon the husband. He had wanted the social cachet of an Eastern bride, but he had also wanted to remain a Texan. He had wanted to forget his noseless grandmother, his strange Quaker grandfather, and especially his obese and ridiculous parents. But Florette often dragged them into conversation, especially when strangers were present. And although he had wanted a wife and had courted Florette arduously, he also wanted to be left alone with his multitude of projects. Had he married a woman of divine patience and sublime understanding, he might have made a success of his marriage. But Florette had proved increasingly giddy and insubstantial. A wiser woman would never have inflated armadillos into a cause célèbre. But once it reached that status, there was no turning back. She charged him with numerous cruelties and more insensitivities. She swore in her affidavit that life with such a brute had become quite impossible, and when the case was well launched, she did the one thing that was calculated to ensure her victory. She hired Fleabate Moomer from Dallas to press her claim for a financial settlement in the Larkin County Court. Ransom's lawyer almost shuddered when he learned that Fleabate was coming into the case. "Ransom, we're in deep trouble." "Why?" "Fleabate tears a case apart. When he's in the courtroom, anything can happen. Do you really want to go ahead with this?" And when Rusk replied, "I sure as hell do, I want to get rid of that millstone," the lawyer felt he had better explain Fleabate Moomer. "He's a country genius, very bright, no morals at all. He'll do anything to win, and I warn you right now that with a case like this, he'll probably win. He gets his name from his habit of scratching himself like a yokel while he's pleading. Scratch here, scratch there. But twice in each case he stops, looks at the jury, crosses his arms, and scratches with both hands. The jury expects this, and they lean forward with special attention, because they know he's going to make an important point. And God help you when he scratches with both hands, because that's when you're going to be crucified. He'll charge you with sodomy, with theft of public funds, with the corruption of juveniles, with murder, with surreptitious dealing with the enemy, anything to make you the hideous focus of the case, and not your poor, wronged wife. Are you strong enough to go up against Fleabate?" Ransom said he thought he was, and the notorious trial began. It was held in that majestic room designed 70 years earlier by James Riley Gordon, and when the disputants began their inflamed accusations, an observer might have wished that the dignified hall of justice had been reserved for worthier cases. The judge was a serious jurist, aware of the sensational nature of the trial he was conducting. But he was powerless against the antics of Fleabate Moomer, who told the jury, "My client, that beautiful and distressed woman you see over there, all she claims in this divorce proceeding is $22 million. Now, that might seem a lot to you, especially if you have to work as hard for your money as I do." And here he wiped his brow, his wrists, and his fingers. "But it will be my duty to prove that the defendant, that slinkin' man over there—" "I object, Your Honor." "Objection sustained. Mr. Moomer, do not cast aspersions on the defendant. That unfeeling, ungentlemanly, ungenerous, and... I object, Your Honor. Objection sustained. You must not attack the defendant, Counselor Moomer. It will be my task to show you good people of the jury that Ransom Rusk, who inherited all his money from his father and never did a day's lick of work in his life... I object, Your Honor. Objection sustained. The jury will disregard everything Counselor Moomer has said regarding the defendant. Fleabate, who wore a string tie, suspenders, a belt, and his hair combed forward in the Julius Caesar style, scratched and mumbled and fumbled his way along, playing the role of the poor country boy doing his best to defend the interests of a wronged wife. But on the third day he stopped abruptly, crossed his arms, and scratched himself vigorously, while the jury, having expected him to do this, smiled knowingly. When he finished scratching, he said ominously, "Had you members of the jury considered the possibility that Ransom Rusk might have been involved with a gentleman in the neighborhood, whose name I refuse to divulge because of my innate sense of decency?" There was a flurry of objections, stampedes to the telephones, and general noise, after which the trial continued. The second time Fleabate scratched with both hands, the jury leaned forward with almost visible delight to hear what scandalous thing was about to be revealed. And this time the lawyer said, "You might well ask, how did Ransom Rusk acquire his wealth? Did he do it by ignoring every decency in the book, every law of orderly business relations between men of honor?" The judge properly ordered this to be stricken, but the jury were as powerless to forget what had been said as they were to ensure Rusk the impartial justice to which he was entitled. Their recommendation was for the full $22 million, which the judge would later scale down to $15 million. Fleabate had told Florette, "We'll go for 22 and be happy if we get 12. Of the award, he would take 40%, or $6 million. On the evening of the adverse verdict, and while it still stood at $22 million, Ransom returned to his big house overlooking Bear Creek and watched with satisfaction as the sun went down. In the darkness, Mr. Kramer stopped by to check on the new fence, and Ransom told him, "I'm happier tonight than I have been in years, free of that terrible millstone." "How did you happen to marry her?" The men of Larkin had long known her to be quite impossible. "Worst reasons in the world, reasons I'm ashamed of, believe me. Like a lot of Texas boys, I went north to Lawrenceville School in New Jersey, one of the best, strong teachers and all that. Well, they had this Father's Day or something, and my parents came up, filthy rich, my father weighing 300, my mother the cartoon version of a Texas oil man's wife, he a slob, she ridiculous in her jewels and oil-field flamboyance. The worst 3 days of my life, because all the boys knew they were super Texas, but out of decency, no one said anything unkind. They just looked and laughed behind my back. When, by the grace of God, my parents finally left, I overheard one of the boys on my hall say, 'She was a walking oil derrick, with the dollar bills dripping off. Poor Ransom.'" In the darkness, he shuddered at that searing memory. Right then, I decided that I would never be oil Texas. I dated the most refined girls from Vassar and Wellesley. I talked art, philosophy, anything to be unlike my father and mother. That's how I met Florette. I think the French name had a lot to do with it, and her determination to be so refined, so Eastern. "To tell you the truth, Ransom, you picked one hell of a lemon. You're well off, especially if you can afford the settlement. Kramer, do you have a pair of wire cutters?" "In the back of my truck." When he returned with the long-handled instrument, which had once been outlawed in these parts, he was surprised when Rusk grabbed it and marched to the wire fence protecting his former wife's bowling green. With powerful clicks, he cut a vertical path from ground to bending tip, then moved to a spot 3 feet away and cut another. When this was done, he called for Mr. Kramer to help him knock the panel flat, trampling it on the ground. Moving farther along to where he thought the armadillos nested, he cut down two more panels. And then the fencebusters, who would have been shot for such action 80 years earlier, returned to the porch where they sat with flashlights. And when the moon was up, Ransom cried with sheer delight, "Here they come!" By morning, the armored destroyers would have that green looking as if it had been run over by careless bulldozers, and Ransom Rusk, $22 million poorer, plus $238,000 for the fence, was happier than he had been in a long time. As soon as Todd Morrison started digging into Houston, he liked what he found. "This town has room for a stepper," he told his wife, "and I think I can step." With the funds provided by the men in Detroit, he began looking around for likely spots at which to locate his franchises, and he became excited about the possibilities. "This place is incredible," he told the family one night. "A population this large and absolutely no zoning. A man can build anything he pleases, and no one can say him nay." He pointed out that this remarkable freedom did not result in a hodgepodge. Some kind of rational good sense seems to prevail. Builders don't go wild. They just do what they damned well please, but they sort of hold things together. As with many operations in a democracy, cost seemed to enforce common sense, for no builder would erect his monumental new set of condominiums next to some hovel. What he did was buy up 400 shacks, level them, and on this cleared land erect his Taj Mahal. Some other builder would do the same half a mile away, erect his Taj Mahal. Some other builder would place his huge Shangri-La half a mile away. And then, out of self-respect, all the property in between would be subtly cleaned up. Houston was not a city. It was an agglomeration of stunningly beautiful spots connected by strips that would be beautiful later on. Zoning on the measles principle, Todd called it. A red splotch here, one over there, and finally, all bound together in interrelated patterns. Houston was the last bastion of free private enterprise, laissez-faire at its best, and Todd relished it. As he worked, he found that a good many of the locations he preferred were controlled by a hard-working real estate agent named Gabe Klinowitz, 63 years old and hardened in the Houston way of doing things. He was a small, round man, smoked a cigar, and wore conservative business suits when the rest of Houston preferred less formal dress. And he was bright, as the success of his firm proved. During his first meeting with Todd, he revealed one of his guiding principles. "I look for the bright young man just entering the field. Help him get started right. Then expect to do profitable business with him for the next 30 years. When Todd said he'd appreciate guidance, Gabe suggested, "What you must do is master the wraparound." "Which is what?" Taking a piece of paper, Klinowitz showed Todd the secret of buying real estate for a large corporation like a gasoline company. "You find a good spot on the corner of two busy roads. The owner has 2 acres, won't break it up into smaller lots. The company, say Mobil or Humble in the old days, they can use 1/4 acre only. That leaves you with 1.75 acres wrapping around the corner in a kind of capital L. Your job as buyer is to buy the entire piece, but not before you've found someone like me who'll take the wraparound off your hands. Do you see the economics?" When Todd said that he did not, Klinowitz asked him to write down the figures. "You personally buy the whole 2 acres from the farmer for $60,000. You've already arranged to sell the choice corner to Mobil for $75,000. And you sell me the wraparound, all that good land next to the corner, for $50,000. Your profit on the deal? A cool $65,000. Morrison studied this for a while, then pointed to the flaw. "But I'm buying this for the company, not for myself." And Klinowitz said, "Before long, I suspect you'll be buying it for yourself." The more Todd worked with Klinowitz, the more he liked him. The man was forthright, quick, and impeccably honest. He was constantly making sharp deals, but he insisted that all participants understand the intricacies, and he would go to great lengths to explain to a farmer whose land he was trying to buy what the good and bad points of the proposed deal were. Often Todd heard him say, "You wait 8, 10 years, undoubtedly you'll get a better buy. But why wait? I promise you, you'll not get a better deal right now than I'm offering." From watching many sales, Morrison learned one secret of Gabe's remarkable success in Houston real estate. "Todd, you must go to bed each night reassuring yourself, this is going to go on forever. I think it is. Houston is going to grow and grow and grow." You told me the other day that compared to Detroit prices, these are outrageous. Todd, I give you my solemn word, the 2 acres you buy today for $60,000, you'll live to see them resell for $600,000. You must tell yourself that every night, and you must believe, this can go on forever. Once when he gave this sermon, he grabbed Todd by the arm. "So you warn me. Gabe, the bottom can fall out of this dream. And I'm the first to confess. Yes, it can, but only temporary. 2, 3 bad years, then we come zooming back. Todd, this really can go on forever." Having confessed that the bottom might drop out temporarily, he gave Todd his first piece of long-range advice. "Always keep yourself in position to weather a few bad years. Fire 3/4 of your staff. Put your wife and kids on a severe allowance. Draw in your horns. Bring the wagons into a circle. But never lose faith. Houston real estate will always bounce back." And then he reached the operative part of his counsel. "Do you see the logical consequences of this situation? If real estate is bound to zoom, it does not really matter how much you pay for a good site today. If you think the corner is worth no more than $40,000 and the farmer wants $60,000, give him the $60,000, but he must allow you to write the terms." What terms? Smallest possible down payment, longest possible payout, lowest possible interest. And he shared with Todd the details of one of his latest deals. "This big corner, prime shopping area in the future, worth, I'd say, $100,000. Farmer thought he'd make a killing and asked $125,000. Without blinking an eye, I agreed. But then I insisted on an 11-year payout and a 6.5% interest. He was glad to sign." What's the point? Don't you see? Suppose I was able to buy it at my price, but had to pay 8% interest for 11 years. Total interest, $88,000. If I pay his price with interest at 6.5%, my interest bill for 11 years is $89,375, only about $1,000 higher. Add that to the extra $25,000 he chiseled me out of, I spent only $26,000 extra dollars to make him very, very happy. He can boast to all his friends, "I certainly handled that sharp Jew real estate fellow." But it still cost you $26,000 extra bucks. Todd, you miss the whole point. If Houston real estate is going to climb like I think, 11 years from now, that corner will bring me not the $125,000 I paid, but more than $1,000,000. You give a little today, you make $1,000,000 tomorrow. And when Todd still deemed it imprudent to pay more now than one had to, Gabe revealed his last principle. Always leave a little something on the table for the other guy. 6 years from now, when the rest of that man's property is for sale, he'll come to me because he'll remember that I treated him square in 1969. I left a little on the table. It was strange, but perhaps inevitable, that of all the advice Gabe Klinowitz shared with his new friend, the one thing that Todd remembered longest was a chance remark. "You may be buying for the company now, but before long you'll be buying for yourself." And the more he contemplated this prediction, the more sensible it became. One night he told his wife, "With a little cash and a lot of gumption, a man could make a killing in this market." He began writing tirelessly about the highways and country roads, looking not for franchise sites, because he had that end of his business rather well in hand, thanks to leads provided by Klinowitz, but for any stray properties which he might one day purchase for himself. And as he rode, he found himself drawn northward, almost as if by magnet, to a peculiarity of the Texas scene, FM 1960. Up to about 1950, Texas had been predominantly an agricultural state, with its laws, banking procedures, and business habits attuned to the rancher and the farmer. Not even oil had exceeded in general and financial interest the importance of the land, and a generation of Texas politicians had invented and supported a creative idea of high quality, the farm-to-market road, which ignored the through highways in favor of the small rural roads that wound here and there, enabling the farmer to bring the produce of his fields to the marketplace in the big towns. Forget the fact that if the quiet farm-to-market road was not well planned, it quite promptly became a jammed thoroughfare. The end result of this commendable system was a network of rural roads equaled in few states. So far to the north of central Houston that it seemed construction could never reach it, a modest farm-to-market had been established in the 1950s called FM 1960. It was a narrow, bumpy road, well-suited to a farmer's slow-moving trucks. But Morrison could see that with a little impetus from a growing population, it had a strong chance of becoming a major thoroughfare. He was so enthusiastic about its possibilities that he took options on two corners, well separated, believing that automobiles must soon be careening past. But when one of the owners of Engine Experts flew down from Detroit, the man decided instantly that these two corners were too far out to be of any use to his company, and Todd was ordered to unload. "We have $8,000 tied up in option money," he protested. And the man said, "That's why you pay out option money, so you gain time to correct mistakes." In no way did he rebuke Todd, for he appreciated what a good job the latter had done in Houston. But long after he had flown back to Detroit, his decision rankled, and it was what happened as a consequence that launched Morrison on his unexpected career. Without telling Klinowitz that he had been forced to unload the options, he went to him and said, "I think I'd better stay closer to town, the kind of market I'm in. I have 8,000 tied up in these two options on FM 1960. Must I lose the down payments, or is there some way I could unload?" When Klinowitz saw the excellent sights, he said immediately, "I'll give you $12,000 for your options right now. They're choice." "Why give 12 when you know I'd be glad to get back my 8, Todd asked. And Gabe said, "Always leave a little something on the table." Now, Morrison faced a grave moral problem. Should he inform the Detroit men of the $4,000 profit he had made on the deal, or should he pocket the windfall? He consulted with no one, not Gabe, not his wife, and certainly not the big men in Detroit. But he did argue with himself. First, I was acting as their agent. Second, they laughed at the deal. Third, what are the chances they'll find out? In the end, he decided to keep the money, and that, along with the $3,000 bonus he received at Christmas, plus the money his wife was earning as receptionist in another big real estate firm, enabled him to enter the new year with a nest egg of more than $11,000 and some tantalizing ideas. In January, as he was exploring further possibilities along FM 1960, he came upon a wedge of farmland owned by an elderly Mr. Hooker, and while Todd was more or less jousting with him over the possibility of buying a corner lot, a white Ford pickup screeched onto the gravel and came to a dusty stop. Apparently the driver was in the oil business, for big letters along the side proclaimed, "Roy Bub Hooker, Drilling." From the cab, which had a two-gun rack behind the driver's head, stepped a big, jovial 24-year-old wearing overalls, cheap cowboy boots, and a checkered bandana. He was your typical Texas redneck, of that there could be no doubt. But when he spoke, it was obvious that he had received a good education. It came not from his teachers, for he had despised school, but from his mother, who had taught him both a proper vocabulary and acceptable manners, neither of which he felt much inclination to use. As soon as he stepped up to Morrison and stuck out his hand, grunting, "Hi, I'm Roy Bubb Hooker, his son," it was obvious that details of any sale would be in Roy Bubb's hands. And during one of the early meetings he explained, "My older sister couldn't say brother, so she stuck me with Bubba, and it became Roy Bubb." He was so shrewd a bargainer, quoting what prices corner lots had brought along FM 1960, that Todd had to warn him, "Hey, look, Roy Bubb, two things. I'm not a millionaire, and I'm not even sure I want to buy." And Roy Bubb snapped back, "Who said my old man wanted to sell?" Since he was almost offensive in the brusque manner in which he dismissed Morrison, Todd felt he must strike back to maintain balance in the bargaining. "They warned me I could never do business with a redneck." "Hey, wait," Roy Bubb cried, as if he were sorely wounded. "I'm no redneck. I'm a good old boy." "What's the difference?" "Hey, a redneck drives a Ford pickup. He has a gun rack behind his ears. He has funny little signs painted on his tailgate. He drives down the highway drinking Lone Star out of a can, which he tosses into the middle of the road." "I don't see the difference. You have a Ford. You have that gun rack. Look at the signs on your tailgate." And there they were, revealing the emotional confusions that activated Roy Bubb and his compadres. "Honk if you love Jesus." "The West wasn't won with a registered gun." "Native-born Texan and proud of it." "Secession now." "Sure I'm drunk. You think I drive this way all the time?" And off to one side, a little dustier than the others, "Impeach Earl Warren." "And," Todd added, "I see you have one of those holders for your Lone Star. So what's the difference?" "Old buddy," Roy Bubb cried, "a redneck throws his empties in the middle of the road. A good old boy tosses his'n in the ditch." No sale could be agreed upon at this time, and the uncertainty gave Morrison sleepless nights in the darkness as he lay beside Maggie, exhausted after her long hours of work and housekeeping. He could never discern whether she liked Houston or not, but she certainly worked at making a good home from whatever Houston provided, and this he appreciated. His nervousness sprang from real causes. The Hooker Corner could be bought, he felt sure, for $71,000, 2¾ acres at a location any expert would classify as superb. He would have to make the deal on his own, because he already knew that engine experts would not be interested. But if he could locate a big gasoline company that wanted a prime spot for a filling station, one that would dominate the market, he might sell off the corner for $60,000, leaving him with 2½ acres for a cost of only $11,000, which would exhaust his savings. However, if he could sell off even a small portion of his wraparound, he could discharge his debt and have 2 acres, or even more, scot-free. Then, if he was energetic, he could sell off more segments of the wraparound and come out a big winner. Also, if he could interest Gabe in some of the land he acquired in this way, he could have his profit in hand before July. And then he could take that profit. During the entire month of January, he slept only fitfully, for the temptations of the deal were so alluring that he spent the first half of each night calculating his possible winnings, and the second half staring in the darkness at the possible catastrophes. In early February, he took his wife, but not his children, into his confidence. "Maggie, I face the chance of a lifetime. This young fellow, Roy Bubb Hooker, has power of attorney to sell a corner lot on FM 1960. We could swing it if, and I repeat if, we could find an oil company to take the corner bit off our hands. We'd wind up with 2½ choice acres practically free. And then if, and again I repeat if..." "Are you trying to convince me or yourself?" she asked. "You know what Houston real estate is doing. I don't have to prove anything." "I know what it's doing for others, who have the land or the money. I'm not so sure what it could do for us." Would you be willing for us to take the risk, all our savings? She said a curious thing. You'd have to tell Detroit, of course. Why? Dealing in property on the side? The temptation would always be to give them the poor deal, keep the good one for yourself. I don't see why they'd have to know anything. I do. Business ethics. The sanctity of the arm's-length deal. Now what do you mean by that? It's something they drummed into me when I got my license. An honest deal involves two people who shake hands across a carefully protected distance. No internal hanky-panky, no secret brother-in-law shakedown. Something in the recent behavior of her fast-moving husband caused her to warn, Todd, any deal you engage in must be at arm's length. On Sunday, she rode out to FM 1960, and as soon as she saw the corner, she wanted to buy it. And after they had supper with Roy Bubb, she liked him even more than she had his land. You're an original, Roy Bubb. Don't ever change. Minute we sell that land, I'm getting me a Cadillac. That'll be the day, she said, and he confided. I'll tell you this. Your husband buys that corner, I'm getting me a first-class stereo for my truck. She shuddered. The new Texas. Roy Bubb roaring down the highway at 90 with his stereo full blast. Won't even hear the siren when the cops chase him. And he said, Ma'am, that's exactly what I have in mind. So on the 4th of February, she gave permission for the deal, if Todd thought he could swing it. And on the 5th, adhering to Gabe's strategy, he agreed to Roy Bubb's price if he could dictate the terms. $9,000 cash on signing, so as you can get that stereo. 11-year payout, 6% interest. Roy Bubb, who had studied so hard to determine the fair price for his land, had paid no attention to the going rates of interest and did not realize that he might have got 7.5% on the unpaid balance. But now, the sweating in the rented house on Quitman Street really began. For when Todd inquired casually among the men who bought land for the big oil companies, he found that they were not eager to locate their filling stations so far north of the city. And although he praised FM 1960 rather fulsomely, they tended to say, Sure, it's good, but we can wait till traffic picks up, if it does. He went through March, April, and May without a nibble. And one night, as he tossed sleeplessly, he faced the fact that come next January, only 7 months away, he would be required to pay Roy Bubb the first installment of interest plus a reduction of the balance, and he could not imagine where he could find that kind of money. Nor had he located anyone interested in his remainder of the wraparound. The future seemed extremely bleak, and he joined that endless procession of Texas gamblers who had risked mightily on the chance of winning big. Matty Quimper had tried to claim both banks of the river in the 1820s, and Floyd Rusk had pulled his own tricks 100 years later when trying to sew up the Larkin Field. It was the Texas game, and all who played it to the hilt sweated in the dark night hours. But, like Todd Morrison in 1969, they gritted their teeth. Something will turn up. His savior, as he might have anticipated, was Gabe Klinowitz. Todd, I believe you're on the pointy end of a long stick. I am, but I put myself there. Have you told the people in Detroit what you're doing? No. You should. Fiduciary responsibility. When lawyers forget about this, they go to jail. You forget, you could be fired. He spoke from the widest possible experience in oil, insurance, real estate, and the legal profession. Men who cut too many corners ran the risk of jail. I'll tell them when I get it sorted out. I hope that won't be too late. He changed his tone. I've heard that an independent is looking for a choice site on FM 1960. Independents pay bottom dollar, don't they? But they pay. When Todd said nothing, Gabe said, Always remember the advice J.P. Morgan gave a young assistant. Young fellow said, Mr. Morgan, how much should a man my age buy on margin? And Morgan said, That depends. And the young fellow said, I've borrowed so much I can hardly sleep at night. And Morgan said, Simple. Sell to the sleeping point. Meaning, Your prime responsibility, Todd, is to get some cash back in your hand. If I offered you $40,000 today, grab it. Pay off your obligations. Make a little less on the deal, but remain in condition to hold on to the rest of your wraparound. Could you get me $40,000? I'm sure I can do better. $51,000, maybe as much as $53,000. My God, that would get me off the hook. He grasped Gabe's hand, then asked, But why would you do this for me? You know you could take it off my hands at whatever price you set and make yourself a bundle. Todd, I have 16 deals cooking. I think you're going to be in this business for the rest of my life. In years to come, we'll arrange 100 deals. I can wait for my big profits. You need your fragile profits right now. They shook hands formally, and Todd said, A man like you is worth a million. And then, just as Todd was about to sign the papers Gabe had sent him, Gulfoil decided that, after all, it would experiment with an FM 1960 location. And they heard that Todd had the inside track on a fine corner. With his knees shaking, Todd told them, I think I could put you on the inside track for $71,000. The Gulf representative, eager to close a deal once the decision had been made by his head office, agreed, and the sale was closed, with Todd and the Gulf man shaking hands. Elated but nervous, Todd now had to inform Klinowitz that the deal with the Independent had to be canceled, even though a gentleman's agreement had been reached. Nothing was signed, you know, Gabe, and Gulf was so hungry to get that land, they demanded an answer right away. I tried to call you, but you were out. And although each man knew that a handshake had sanctified the sale to the Independent, Gabe merely said, I'll find them something, but Todd, I hope you inform Detroit that you've been dealing on your own. There are rules to this game, you know. And Todd said, Absolutely. But the letter he had drafted in his head, aware that it ought to be sent, was never written.